Trouble.
Go ahead.
Oh, I can go now. Dave Koppel. All right. Welcome. Thanks, man.
Thank you.
Thanks for hanging in there.
Well, good morning, and it's a great morning celebrating the combined 100th anniversary of the Second Amendment Foundation and the Citizens Committee for the Right to Keep and Bear Arms. One of them 51 years old, the other 49. And it's also, especially for Californians, but really for the whole country, a great morning after Judge Benitez issued his opinion striking down the California magazine confiscation law. And immodestly, I will tell you that what I'm going to talk about this morning is based on a forthcoming article. It's been pre-published on the internet. That Joseph Greenlee and I wrote for the Notre Dame's Journal of Legislation, and he cited and quoted from that article in his opinion. And immodestly, I will also tell you that this is the 95th judicial opinion in which my briefs or scholarship have been cited. And interestingly, if you look at, you know, especially say in the past couple of years in this post-Bruin era, the citations to my scholarship come about 50-50 in cases, some of which say, oh, this particular government action or gun control is unconstitutional, and the other half say, or come in cases where the government's position is upheld. And the reason I get cited on for either result is my scholarship is accurate. That is, unlike some people, like people who perpetrate deliberate frauds, such as Saul Cornell, I tell the truth in my scholarship and provide all the facts, including things that you know might be not supportive of a policy outcome I would favor, but all the facts are there, and so they're reliably there for judges to use, whatever the judge's objective. All right, so after the Bruin remands, besides ruling in Bruin, the Supreme Court granted, vacated, and remanded four cases, one of which was the California magazine ban. It was fairly clear that the gun prohibition lobbies were going to have a challenging situation justifying gun bans under Bruin's original meaning test as informed by history and tradition. So, and I knew that they would immediately start going after Bowie knives. And this article describes the full history in the United States and actually England before that of bans on particular types of arms. So let's go through that. In 1837, the Georgia legislature banned the sale and carrying, whether open or concealed, of a wide variety of arms, all handguns other than horsemen's pistols, which are quite large handguns made to be carried in the saddlebags of a horse, as well as bowie knives, sword canes, dirks, lots of other stuff. The Georgia Supreme Court in 1844, in the case of Nunn v. State, held the ban to be unconstitutional and a violation of the Second Amendment for all of those arms, normal-sized handguns, bowie knives, sword canes, all that, and said the only part of this law that's valid is the prohibition on concealed carry. So that's our first firearms ban of the century. Later, after the Civil War in 1879 and 1881, after Reconstruction was over and the white supremacists had control of the Tennessee and Arkansas legislatures, they banned the sale of all handguns other than the Army and Navy models. In other words, other than the largest, most expensive, highest quality, most powerful, largest magazine capacity handguns. You could buy those, and a lot of former Confederate officers already had them from the war, but former the former the freemen, the former slaves, as well as poor whites might have trouble acquiring such an expensive gun. And then in 1893 in Florida, after some incidents in which black people used repeating rifles to drive off lynch mobs, the legislature enacted a law that said to have a Winchester or other repeating rifle, you need a license from the county commissioner. The county commissioners and the license costs, you have to put up a bond of $100, which was the equivalent of about $3,000 today. And it was, as the Florida Supreme Court later said, it was never intended to be enforced against the white population and conceded to be unconstitutional if contested. So now you've got the whole history of firearms bans in the United States, which is not a very long history, up to 1900, and doesn't give the gun prohibition folks much to work with. So let's move on to Bowie knives here. We have September 19th, 1827, was the famous sandbar fight where on a sandbar near Natchez, Mississippi, Jim Bowie used a knife in a fight with some other guy, and it got into the newspapers, and they kept on reporting it and exaggerating and going on and on. According to Norman Fladerman, who's the late Norman Fladerman, great gun collector and writer about arms history and the author of the definitive book on Bowie knives, the knife that Jim Bowie used at that fight, made by his brother Rezin, nothing new about it. I mean, it was a big knife. You could use it for fighting a bear, for example. But there was nothing particularly distinctive about that compared to, it was just another typical knife. But newspapers got a hold of it, and soon you had companies in both England and the United States marketing Bowie knives. And the guns, the knives that they marketed as Bowie knives were all kinds of different things. There was nothing that they had in common with each other. But the name sticks, and so by the mid-1830s, you have the beginnings of legislative action against Bowie knives. Mississippi, for example, enacting a statute that says if you use it in a crime, you're going to get extra punishment. And then the wave of Bowie knife laws really, we'd had two states that acted before what I'm about to tell you. But then you have an incident in the Arkansas legislature where the Speaker of the House and another state representative get into an argument over who's in charge of the money that the state pays for bringing in certain animal pelts. And they each pull out a Bowie knife and on the floor of the legislature get into a brawl, and one of them is fatally wounded, and the other one ends up getting criminally prosecuted and then acquitted by the jury. But this is understandably a great cause of concern. And so you have a number of states in the Southeast acting fairly quickly with legislation on the topic. Where it ultimately settles down is, of course, we have the Georgia law, but that ban was held unconstitutional to violate the Second Amendment. Likewise, in Texas, after it becomes a state, the state Supreme Court says, of course, a Bowie knife is part of the Texas and U.S. right to keep and bear arms. The government can't ban them, and they can't stop people from carrying them, but it's okay to impose extra punishment that if you could commit a manslaughter with a Bowie knife, you're in much more trouble than if you'd committed a manslaughter by some other means. Nevertheless, we have Tennessee enacts a sales ban on Bowie knives in this period. Then much later, around 1881, Arkansas also enacts a sales ban, and throughout the century, we have three other states, Mississippi, Alabama, and North Carolina, that tax Bowie knives and also sometimes small handguns in the annual personal property taxes at rates that are high enough. They're not prohibitory, but they're fairly high taxes in relationship to the value of the knife, so they discourage it. So that's our anti-Bowie laws. The vast majority of other jurisdictions in the United States, instead of trying to ban them or discourage them with taxation, enact one of three or all three laws. One is no concealed carry. The other is if you use it in a crime, you're in worse trouble than if you used another weapon, especially if you use it in a duel. And third, don't sell them to minors. And that's the mainstream approach. And that is the mainstream approach that is also adopted for other controversial weapons of the period, of which the top is the slungshot. Probably few of you are carrying a slungshot right now. A slungshot is you can make a classic slungshot, which is what sailors used it for. It's for casting lines. Take the end of your rope, put a lead weight towards the end, and then wrap the rope around that, and that with a particular type of knot that's called a monkey's fist. Or you can just make and then it's easier to cast your mooring line because it's got a weight on it. You can make a land-based version of that. Here's how to do it. You can manufacture one at home, and you do not need a 3D printer for this, so this is a very dangerous situation. Take a sock. Get about $5 worth of quarters, or some sand, or dirt, or pebbles, or whatever. But, about that amount of weight. Put it in the toe of the sock. Tie off a knot to keep the load there stable. And you now have a slungshot that can be used as a weapon either offensively or defensively. It is not the most... A blow to the head can be fatal, but it's not primarily a lethal weapon, but it is a... It was a criminal favorite because it's silent, it doesn't necessarily leave a mark, and it's very easy, probably the easiest weapon for a sudden sneak attack. So there are ultimately 10 states or territories that outlaw the manufacture or sale of slung shots. Metallic knuckles end up by the end of the 19th century, their sale being outlawed in 6 states, and New York outlaws the sale of the sand club, which is in the broad cap. Slung shots are in the broad class of saps, likewise a blackjack is one, or sand club is one type of sap. And that's the history of the bans. And again, the mainstream approach is not the bans, it's the regulation of concealed carry, sales to minors, and so on. So I suggest, and at least Judge Benitez agreed, that overall this history indicates that bans on common arms, particularly different types of knives or firearms, are not part of our 19th century tradition of understanding the right to bear arms, whereas regulations such as restrictions on concealed carry are legitimate and prohibitions are not. And I think I've got, I'm on time and under budget.
You are right smack on time.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you, Dave. Appreciate it very much. Great stuff.